so hot right now.
Caliente ahora.
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot right now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Good morning and welcome to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of all things arts and culture. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people who are the traditional custodians of this land. I would also like to pay respect to elders both past and present of the Eora Nation. Now, this show is completely and totally full. We have an amazing array of events that we're going to be talking about. I don't really have enough time to give you a full overview, but I'll just shout out a few things. We're talking about Extinction of Learned Response at Belvoir Street Theatre, which is a super interesting production all about what it means to be human. Talking about the Hidden Pulse, which is part of the Vivid Live lineup. Also, here is Your Horizon, which is the latest exhibition opening at Cement Fondue, which I'm really excited about. And first on the agenda, I'm talking about Blue Ridge Moon, which is opening at Pom Pom, Gallery Pom Pom in Chippendale this Thursday. And that is coming up next. So I'm just going to start with a track. This one is a new one from Sydney producer Pool Room. This is The Future. You are tuned into So Hot Right Now.
Trip to the future. Future.
Portland-based experimental artist Grupa makes her Sydney Opera House debut this May for Vivid Live. Turning the intimate Utzon room into an uncanny world of dreamy sounds, Grupa will embrace piano, guitar, tape collage and field recordings to perform her hauntingly beautiful music. Book now for Grupa at Vivid Live this May 24 and 25 at sydneyoperahouse.com. To SER sponsors.
Hello and welcome back to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of all things arts and culture. That track there was from Pool Room. That is his new one, The Future. He also happens to be my amazing super fill-in producer today. So thank you for making great music and being a good friend. Anyway, so you are tuned in to So Hot Right Now. And right now I am talking about Blue Ridge Moon. So I want you to imagine an experimental art school that fosters female creativity and kinship, where models of generative and adaptive communal living prioritize creative play, reimagining the way that we choose to live in communities. Black Mountain College in Asheville, North Carolina, offered this kind of education. Embedded within the institution's history is the progressive vision of an art-driven sustainable lifestyle. Artist Kylie Banyard plays tribute to this school and its legacy in her work, Blue Ridge Moon. And I'm joined by Kylie this morning to tell us a little bit more about it. Good morning, Kylie.
Good morning.
So this work, as I mentioned, is all about this school, Black Mountain College. Can you describe the school in a little bit more detail?
Yeah, sure. So it ran in the kind of mid-20th century, so from 1930s through to the mid-50s. So it doesn't exist anymore, but the buildings that made up the college do, and different things happen there now. But the college itself was, it was a liberal arts college, and so they were studying all sorts of things, not just art and music and theatre, but across the arts. But I'm really interested in the way that basically everybody who went there was very isolated. Everybody who chose to go there lived on campus, including the faculty. So everybody lived together. So it was truly a communal way of living. And they worked on the land and they grew the food that they ate, along with some kitchen and garden staff that the students and faculty worked alongside, and they built a lot of the buildings that they studied in. So it was a really kind of radical experiment that encompassed this idea of a total environment, which I think is pretty special, and I don't know that it's been done a lot since then. Yeah.
Do you know why it ceases to exist?
So it always ran on a shoestring. It wasn't very well funded. Basically, I think the faculty, the staff didn't make much money. The college didn't bring in a lot of money. So the other thing that happened is that there were a lot of really big egos there as well. And this is one of the things about communes. Often they're very fraught, and the reality of them is generally that they come undone. So I think there was just sort of a political explosion amongst people, and it fell to pieces eventually, which is sad.
Yeah, definitely. So the women's histories of this school in your work is described as hidden. Why was it hidden, and was it difficult to find out information about these histories?
Not once I started looking, but the funny kind of disjunction that I noticed really early on was, and it's just symptomatic of the way art history is, I guess, has previously been taught, and the way the canon has previously been constructed. But you look at the images, or the archival images, and there are so many of them available. Heaps of them are online. There are lots of women there, lots of female students, as is always the case at art schools, eternally. Lots of women taught at the college too, but the way the history is written doesn't match the way that it looks in the images. So I'm kind of interested in that visual culture, I guess. And also there were lots of really big iconic male artists that spent time at the college. So when the college is talked about, that's a really obvious way to grab people's attention, is to, historically, to talk about the iconic, big heroic male artists that had something to do with it, like Joseph Albers and Willem de Kooning and people like that. So, yeah, that usually the roll call is the way that it announces its kind of prestige and historical importance. So I wanted to to shine a light on some of the people that don't get talked about in the written history, which is the women.
Definitely. And so in creating this work, as you mentioned, you delved into archival research and mm-hmm. both written and photographic. And you also, from my understanding, combined that with your own photographic images. How did that nexus come about and what's the result of that?
Yeah, so I haven't really done that before. And mostly because this is kind of maybe the third or fourth community that I've looked at over the course of a decade. And usually they're places that I haven't visited and that I've been very conscious to force this sort of critical distance between me and the place that I'm researching, because I'm interested in being able to construct a fantasy and an ideal kind of fantasy about the place. So going there is one sure way to dispel the kind of, you know, fantastic illusion that I might have about a place. But what happened with this project is that I got some funding and I was able to actually go to Asheville, which is very close to Black Mountain, to the Black Mountain Museum and Art Centre, and talk to some of the people who are experts in Black Mountain, and they've researched it there for most of their working lives, and talk to them. So some scholars that write about it. And I got to go to Black Mountain, and I also went and I was in an exhibition at Appalachia at a university in Boone, which is very close and very involved in looking at the history of Black Mountain College. So when I was there, I took lots of photos of the incredible place that I stayed in the mountains with one of the staff from the university that I was, visiting and exhibiting at. And I started to incorporate and kind of conflate my experience of visiting and the archival images that I'd found of the college and people working at the college.
And with the discourse surrounding the college, because it's come up a few times in terms of writing and scholars and there being a museum, is it primarily a kind of positive outlook on the college, or is it contrary to that?
No, it's really, and in America, it's really. So when I went on my research trip, I went to New York first, and I did some research there, and it's really celebrated as this important moment in kind of avant-garde art history, mid-20th century avant-garde moment where something radical happened. And so it's really very, very celebrated. And most of the accounts, even the kind of lived experience, when you start reading accounts that of people's time at Black Mountain, mostly it was positive. But, you know, sometimes there are that people didn't enjoy themselves at all. Sometimes people do, I guess, pay attention to the way that it was quite politically fraught, and there were lots of clashing egos and issues. But, you know, like any organisation, people don't always get along. So, yeah, generally it's held up as this really positive, amazing historical moment.
Yep. So Blue Ridge Moon functions a little bit as a tribute to the college. What are you hoping that uncovering these histories in a modern context will kind of... How will that affect Australian audiences specifically in such a different kind of context?
I don't even know that I've thought about how it will affect Australian audiences. I think one thing that in a kind of universal sense, and it doesn't matter where the audience is, but I'm wanting to give female creativity really kind of a full representation and really celebrate women in the act of making and just enjoying, you know, having creative lives. And that's what I'm really interested in, I guess, celebrating and exposing and making work about.
And that is a completely wonderful intent, I think. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Kylie. Good luck with the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No problem. That was Kylie Banya talking about her solo exhibition, Blue Ridge Moon, which opens at Gallery Pom Pom in Chippendale on May 15th. So get down for opening night. It's on the 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. Right now I'm going to play a track. This is from Melbourne band HTRK. Give It Up. You are tuned into So Hot right now.
Thank you. Pursue a career in film, TV, radio, or digital media?
Learn the basics or brush up on your skills with a winter intensive short course at the Australian Film, TV, and Radio School.
Practical, hands-on, and taught by top industry practitioners. AFTERS 5-day courses run during June and July.
Enroll now at aftrs.edu.au.
Book now for the early bird discount.
AFTERS sponsors 2SER.
You are tuned into 2SCR 107.3, listening to So Hot Right Now, which is all things arts and culture. And right now I am talking about new production Extinction of the Learned Response, which details an intriguing scenario where scientists attempt to alter human behaviour. We are introduced to two scientists, Duncan and Marlowe, sitting with their two subjects, Rachel and Wells. The play delves into a twisted experiment where the scientists attempt to manipulate human behaviour. But things go awry when they realise, as Rachel and Wells grow older, they are not responding the way the scientists want. And I am joined by writer Emmy Ho and director Carissa Lecidello. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Hello.
So I alluded a little bit to the story in my intro there, but would one of you or both of you like to give me give everyone a little bit more of an in-depth synopsis?
Carissa?
All right, I'll do it. So you're exactly right. We open with two scientists sitting with their two subjects, and we learn that they've gone to live in seclusion and get away from the rules and work on this experiment together. And things seem to be going well, and the subjects are getting more and more human. So we're kind of wondering what they are, but of course things don't totally go to plan in the experiment. And as things start to get more and more out of hand, the two scientists who also are in a relationship start
That complicates it.
It really does. And what ends up happening in the experiment really reflects back on how they feel about themselves and their relationship and makes them rethink everything that they thought was certain.
Okay, wow, it's a lot going on.
Yeah.
I'm interested in these scientist characters. Are they, like, obviously there's a lot of tropes around scientists, especially doing crazy things. Are these do they embody kind of a normal person or more of like a crazy scientist idea?
I think what I was really interested in when I wrote it was mixing this sort of science fiction genre with real life. So I wanted it to feel like, you know, psychological realism, kitchen sink drama in this strange world, this strange scientific experiment world. And I think, so yeah, I really hope they feel like real people in a real relationship, and that's the core of the work.
And is it set in a contemporary context?
It's sort of, what do you think, Carissa?
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a contemporary nowhere. Like we, you know, it's in Australian accents. It very much feels like now, but we're not totally sure where they are.
Right.
So, yeah.
Bit of a sense of seclusion.
Yes.
Going on. Great. And so obviously the content of this show is a little bit twisted and particularly interesting. So I just wanted to ask, Emmy, what inspired you to tell this kind of narrative?
I think way back when I was doing my undergraduate degree, I read The Island of Dr. Moreau by H.G. Wells, which is a psychological horror science fiction. And that is very genre. But I think I would that core of the idea, which I can't say because it gives away a twist.
It's always a balancing act between, like...
But there's this real sort of grotesque, uncanny idea at the centre of the work, which I wanted to bring into this play and to sort of put that up against psychological realism and see what happens. So I think that's the core of it. And also, theatre is such a great place to explore language and what's underneath language. Mm. And I think that was a really central part of the play as well and why I wanted to write it.
And so you were both writer and director. Did you have much of a collaboration process between the two of you?
Yeah, we did. Emmy had written a play a few years ago when she was at NIDA as a kind of graduation work. So Emmy had sat with it for much longer than I have. But when we decided to put it into production, we kind of sat down together and were like, okay, this is what we both think. And I think along the way, I felt like my job was to make sure that I got the compass of the work right. I figured out what the compass was for Emmy and what mine was and how that worked together. And then along the way, yeah, we kind of were back and forth. You know, I'd be in the rehearsal room and then we'd chat and then Emmy might write something and we bring it back into the room. So it was always very moving kind of step by step together, which worked for me. Yeah. I don't know how it was for you, but...
It's been fantastic.
Yeah.
And I also feel like you learn so much the second you see it up on the floor and in the actor's mouths. And I think that's really been an amazing part of the collaboration, is actually shaping it to this production as well.
And central to the production is this idea of like inviting audiences to question what makes us human. Mm. Why do you think that's an important question to ask? And does this work provide any answers at all or stimulation?
I think it does. And I think a lot of what I was interested in what makes us human is, how does language function in terms of what makes us human? How does language make us powerful or weak or inarticulate or articulate? And what's the difference between, I can't say that, that'll give something away, but like, I think, you know, those that can speak and those that can't speak. And what does that power dynamic mean? And so in terms of humanity and language, I think it's really closely entwined, and that is a real ethical question at the centre. And I think the answer is sort of left up to the audience. I think we do provide something, but it's interesting to see what the audience feel as they walk away.
Have you been able to interact with audiences at all?
Yeah, we have a little. I on opening night, I kind of went around polling people. I was like, okay, so I want to know how did this bit of the story work for you, and what did you think about this, and blah, blah, blah. And it was really interesting getting people's different responses. And even we had a Q&A last night with some students as well, and it's interesting seeing how people come to work from different angles. And I think something that we were just talking about outside before this interview was about, you know, we've made a work that's intentionally a bit tricky, and there's a mystery in the story, but also in the way that it plays out, there is, you know, abstraction and things that aren't easily definable. And yeah, I don't know that you're able to come away at the end and go, oh, I know exactly what that was about. Like, I think some people might, but I think part of the exciting thing about the experience should be that you can kind of be leaning in and figuring out and processing, and maybe days later something will drop in and you'll be like, oh, I get what that image is or this idea. And yeah, so I think I'm interested to check in with people even like a few days after and see where they're at.
Totally.
In an ideal world, how would you want the work to affect audiences?
I think I want audiences to lean in and listen and feel the sense of the uncanny or the wrongness, but also the intimacy in the work. Like, I actually think that's always been, for me, part of the key of it, is the sense of, like, longing and intimacy and emotions that can or can't be expressed. And so I think for people to be affected by the emotional heart and not just the sort of sci-fi plot is the goal of for me.
And what about you, Carissa?
Yeah, I think I hope that people have moments of quite a visceral experience in there, whether something taps you know, it taps into them emotionally, and also that there is a kind of metaphysical fear that's under the work that I find really interesting. And I hope that there are moments where people get a flash of that and just leave feeling like they've had an experience that is in their minds and their bodies as well. Yeah.
That's nice.
So the Extinction of the Learned Response is showing at the Downstairs Theatre at the Belvoir Street Theatre from now until May 25th, and tickets only $25. We'll put all the details up on our show page so you can find them there. Thank you so much for joining us. That was wonderful.
Thanks.
Right now I'm going to play a little bit more music. This one is from Pink Matter. This is Cleo. You are listening to So Hot Right Now.
We'll be right back. I think I've seen you here before.
Spunk has a host of new autumn releases. Helado Negra's This Is How You Feel was just given Pitchfork's Best New Music. Mac DeMarco's fifth album, Here Comes the Cowboy, arrives May 10th. Talking Spunk, come celebrate 20 years of the label at the Sydney Opera House on May 24th and 25th, with a headline performance from the Middle East on both nights, plus special guests. Spunk is a proud supporter of 2SER.
Hello and welcome back to So Hot Right Now on 2SCR FM 107.3. My name is Nicole Beck and I have been with you since 11 a.m, which means we've got just under half an hour left of arts and culture content, and I have absolutely no time to wait. So right now I am talking about Vivid Live. So there's obviously an extensive program of ideas, light and music with Vivid, and there is clearly something for everyone. And this morning I am chatting about The Hidden Pulse, which is, as I mentioned, on the live lineup, and it is the first ever moving image program in Vivid Live's 11-year history. So the Sydney Opera House is collaborating with Hong Kong's Museum of Visual Culture, M+, presenting artists' videos, films and talks that use contemporary music and performance as their stimuli. The Hidden Pulse explores the capacity of music and performance to build community, resist authority, transform culture, shape identity, excavate history and reclaim space. Joining me to unpack this huge amount of content and programming is the curator for the Sydney Opera House. Her name is Sarah Reeds. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Nicole. Thanks.
How are you?
Well, thanks.
So can you just give us a little bit of an overview of a few of the main events happening as part of the Hidden Pulse?
Absolutely. So the entire program is, like you said, it's a moving image-based program, but there's also artists who are coming out to give talks and to present screenings of their works. So I guess we start off, the first event is Arthur Jafar. He's going to show a screening of his incredible work, Love is the Message, The Message is Death, and then we'll be in conversation with artist and artistic director of the Biennale, Brooke Andrew. And we've got Wu Sang coming as well. So she'll be in conversation with Alexi Glass-Cantor, and then screening her film Into a Space of Love. And then we have a cinema concert with Cheng Ran and Xiao Yangpen, who will be performing a live electronic soundtrack to Cheng Ran's dialogue-free film. So they're the live events. And then we've also got 2 days of screenings and panel discussions. And we've also got Stan Douglas, a six-hour work that will be installed in the drama theatre that people can sort of walk in and out of and experience. It's an incredible film, and that will be running repeatedly through the week. And then we've also got a night of screenings of works by Charles Atlas. So, yeah, like you said, it's a huge program. There's, I guess, the overview, but, yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah, sure. So the program is not only huge, but it's also incredibly diverse, featuring works from artists all over the world with a huge range of histories being explored in a variety of ways. What are the commonalities that perhaps connect these cross-cultural and cross-disciplinary works?
Well, like you said, they all sort of use music and performance as their stimuli. It was really important with Yolanda and I curating the program that we really make it right for the context within Vivid and within the Sydney Opera House. So performance was always going to be a key theme, and music as well being in Vivid. So that, I guess that's the thing that connects all of the program together across. And it's also this sort of universal language as well. But it's interesting to see how things are, I guess, misinterpreted or change when you are crossing cultures as well.
Definitely. And so the Hidden Pulse also explores, as you've kind of alluded to, the intersection between moving image, music and performance. And why do you think it's important to look at this intersection? What do you think it shows us about our world?
Well, I guess, like I said, it is quite a universal language that is accessible, I think, to everyone. And its expression and a lot of this work comes out of subcultures, and there are, like you sort of said before, it's about resisting authority or reclaiming space. It's sort of such a fertile area of creativity and artistic production. And yeah, I think globally there's been such a proliferation of kind of performance and live works in recent years. So yeah, I think the works in this program really reflect that.
I'm really interested as well in your collaboration with M+. And for those who don't know, that's a really large institution in Hong Kong that actually doesn't have a physical museum or anything at the moment, but it's doing a lot of amazing things for visual culture in Hong Kong. How did this collaboration come about? And yeah, how did that help add to the program?
Yeah, well, they will have a museum opening
2020.
It's going to be absolutely huge.
Insane, yeah.
And which is so exciting. It's really exciting for our region. I was sort of aware of what was happening at M+. And actually, Yolanda and I were introduced by a mutual colleague. And I think I was really interested in working forming, I guess, a relationship with M+, being that they're going to be this huge powerhouse art institution in our region. So it was a great opportunity to start working together. So Yolanda and I were introduced and we realized, you know, we had a lot of shared interests. And for me, I wanted to really learn more about the works that were coming out of China and the Asia Pacific. So it's been incredible. It's been a great learning experience, and also having access to M+'s collection as well. They've got some, you know, their collection's growing all the time, but they've got some incredible work. So, yeah, it was kind of an opportunity that was, you know, too good not to try and make happen. And I'm thrilled with how it's come about.
100%. And just to finish off, what are you hoping, or why did you want to involve this kind of exploration into moving image, music and performance in the Vivid lineup for 2019, and how are you hoping people interact with it and take away from it?
Well, I think it was funny. I actually was reminded of when Solange came for Vivid Live last year and was talking about her music not being solely for entertainment or consumption, that, you know, that there were much deeper reasons for why she makes her art. And it sort of made me think about a lot of music and popular culture, how audiences consume work. And I thought this is a great opportunity to tell stories of the social context and the histories behind works rather than just simply consuming them. So I guess I hope audiences can unpack some of the histories and context behind the works in this program and be introduced to new artists from all over the world, because we've been lucky enough to have such a, like you said, diverse international list of participating artists, which is really exciting to have here in Australia.
100%. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I can't wait to check out The Hidden Pulse.
Thanks, Nicole. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So that was curator Sarah Rees, ahead of Vivid Lives, The Hidden Pulse. This is all happening from May 29th until June 2nd. And there's a huge variety of programs that you can buy tickets to, and we'll put the links up to the full program up on our show page if you search for So Hot Right Now on the 2SER website. It is 11:40 on your Saturday morning. I'm going to play another song. This is from Tops. This is Cut Loose Cruiser. You are tuned into 2SER. Thank you.
same road again. Sisters in the master bedroom. Time to dig that hole again. You had the tools, but you did not choose them. You are a cutlass cruiser. I'm just a part-time loser now. Do you take scars or bruises? Our hair proof that we struggled somehow.
Supporters at 2SER. To give back, we have regular supporter-only giveaways with tickets to gigs, movies, the theatre, exhibitions and more. Look out for 2SER e-news in your inbox to see what you could win. Stories, ideas, music and free stuff.
You win!
You are tuned into So Hot Right Now with myself, Nicole Beck. It is about quarter to midday on your Saturday morning, which means I've got one more wonderful story for you. And we're going to be talking about Cement Fondue's latest exhibition, Here Is Your Horizon, which explores the contemporary Pacific experience of adornment and more specifically the ways in which it has moved beyond the traditional. Presenting newly commissioned work as well as reimagined works from Pacific heritage artists from New Zealand and Australia, Here Is Your Horizon shares experiences of what adornment means and how it can be told through art making. And I'm lucky enough to be joined by curator of the show, Talia Smith. Good morning.
Good morning.
So for those who might know, can you give us a little bit more of an idea of what the concept of adornment means and its cultural significance?
I guess firstly, I am Samoan and Cook Island and New Zealand European heritage, and I've been living in Sydney for 5 years. So exciting opportunity, firstly, for me to bring over some New Zealand artists to explore this idea. But I guess culturally and traditionally, adornment was or is, it still is, something that is, you know, very costume based. And in those kind of traditions of dance or presentations or ceremony, so also it's very involved with that. So it's things like what a chief could wear, whether it's a headpiece, their actual piece of clothing, jewellery. That's kind of the cultural significance of it. And it sort of showed, I guess, in some instances, their position in that sort of hierarchy of society. So, you know, depending on how adorned that particular headdress was, it meant something else compared to someone's that was a bit plainer. You know, it's that kind of relationship. And so for this exhibition, I really wanted to look at what adornment can mean in a contemporary sense, because, you know, I am second generation New Zealand born Pacific Island heritage person, and that's very different to someone who was born in the Pacific Islands or still lives within that culture. So, yeah.
And so a lot of the works, or there's a combination, as I mentioned, of reimagined works as well as newly commissioned. Mm-hmm. So did you approach certain artists and ask them to explore adornment? I'm interested to know how they responded to that question.
Yeah, I guess. So I came onto this show with Cement Fondue with them having a loose idea of what they wanted to do already, which was kind of basically just the word adornment is what they sort of had. And then I went from there. But I, with the newly commissioned works, I actually contacted people that I sort of knew that worked within what I was wanting from the show. So it wasn't kind of a surprise to them, because they already sort of, they were kind of unpacking those sorts of themes anyway in their work. So when I contacted, it was just kind of like, I was either, hey, I really love this work, can we have it in the show? The show is about this. Or would you be keen to kind of do something a little bit new or a little bit different in the sort of vein of the show? Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about the works that are featured in the exhibition?
Yeah, definitely. So we have Nikki Hastings McFall, who is an installation artist who will be coming over from New Zealand. And she's very famous for lei bombing. So lei as in like the flower leis that you get when you go to Pacific Islands, or you can buy them from $2 stores. You know, they're made of that crappy fabric, which is probably very bad for the environment. Yeah.
Yeah. Synthetic.
Anyway, but she, I guess it's like crochet bombing in that kind of way. So she kind of, like trees, anything, she'll adorn with leis or objects that are kind of seemingly traditionally Pacific, but because they're presented in a different material, like the synthetic leis, she's kind of talking about the commodification of Pacific culture. And so she's coming to do a site-specific installation, wow, which is very exciting.
Very exciting.
And she's going to walk with UNSW students, although I believe that other people, you know, are welcomed to come from, I think, the UNSW galleries on Saturday the 25th of May.
I'm a UNSW student. I should go.
Yes. From, I think, at about 5-ish.
Okay.
It's on their website and everything. And then you'll walk down to Cement Fondue and you'll be lay-bombing along the way.
Wow.
Yeah, so it'll be really, really fun. And Nikki will be sort of doing a kind of informal artist talk as well with students or anyone interested. So Cement Fondue's website has all those details. But that's Nikki. And then also another work that we have is Serene Timotea from New Zealand as well. She has created this kind of homage to a traditional Tongan mat that her grandmother had, which had Queen Salote on it. It was something that was kind of, it was gifted to her grandmother and had a lot of really beautiful significance for their family. So she usually works with traditional mats and embroiders her own designs over the top of them. And so she's working with an existing plain mat and then putting in her own sort of designs that reference the relationship she has with her grandmother and also the traditional mat that has Queen Salote on it. Yeah.
So there's a lot of works involved. You just mentioned a couple of them.
Yes.
And they cross a variety of disciplines. I was interested in, curatorially speaking, how you hope these installations and video works and photography and site-specific works interact in the Cement Fondue space.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it sounds really cheesy and I...
Nah.
And as a Pacific person, I always cringe at this kind of thing, but Pacific Island culture is fun and vibrant and funny and exciting and, you know, humble but also not humble. And I think that by including these many artists and the different practices they have, I really want to show that we are more than just a frangipani behind somebody's ear or, you know, a traditional lei that we wear on our head. We are more than that, and that is part of our culture for sure, but we're also more than that. And I'm pretty excited to be able to get an audience to see that. There's so much exciting contemporary Pacific Island art, and this is a way to celebrate that.
Do you think contemporary Pacific Island art is excluded from perhaps the Sydney art world scene?
In some ways, like, there's obviously a larger conversation around the idea of identity, and I think identity is important, and it is in everything that anyone does because it's about you. So it's never not there, but I think that sometimes people of colour or artists of colour can be relegated to just identity shows. And so that's why with this show, it's like, it's about the contemporary experience and how I want people to see that these works are more than, like, I want to say more than identity.
Yeah, definitely. Identity.
But they are about identity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, in a more kind of in-depth and
a
different angle.
Yeah. Totally, yeah.
So as part of the kind of, I guess, programming element, there's an Instagram takeover by Sione Monu. I'm interested in how, like, you've created an intersection between adornment and technology and just contemporary practice in life. Can you discuss that?
I think an artist called Janet Lilo, who is a New Zealand-based artist, she was kind of someone that I really... I admire her practice a lot, but it's also someone that I kind of first realised the importance of technology for Pacific peoples, and especially with art making. So she did this project a while back now that was, I don't know if you ever knew Bebo. Bebo was like a MySpace type site.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Predating MySpace?
Well, I think it was kind of at the same time,
right.
But it was a very popular social media networking type thing amongst Pacific Islanders, like families. It was a way of connecting with people in the islands, and it was really, really fun and weird, and you could, like, change the skin of it and all of this and, like, add songs, that kind of thing. And so it became, like, kind of a culture, a part of Pacific Island culture in a way. So she had work about that, and I've always been really interested in how, despite being sometimes very far removed from this idea of the Pacific Islands, we can still connect through the waves of the internet. And so I wanted to make sure to kind of represent that in the show as well, because it is really important, and Instagram is, like, crazy important to everybody, you know.
For some reason.
Exactly. Well, I love it. So
yeah.
Having Sione, who I know predominantly works with Instagram, with his short little videos, which are beautiful. And he has a really beautiful way of storytelling through a very, you know, limited time. Like, I don't know how long videos can be on Instagram, but short.
Very short.
But he manages to still be able to convey his message and tell a story really honestly and earnestly just through that sort of medium. Yeah.
Definitely. And just one last question. I think you previously alluded to it, but in an ideal kind of world, how would you like viewers to respond to Here Is Your Horizon?
I would like viewers to walk away excited by what is happening with contemporary Pacific heritage art, and want to work with these artists. That's what I would really like.
Yeah, that's a great outcome for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show this morning.
Thank you.
Good luck with the show. So we've just been speaking with Talia Smith about Here Is Your Horizon. This exhibition opens at Cement Fondue on May 25th. And as always, it's completely free. It's a great gallery. If you haven't been there, I highly recommend you check it out. There's also a series of programs to check out, which Talia also alluded to earlier on. And we'll put all the links and important info up on our show page. Right now, I'm going to play a track. This is Leon Vinehall with Saxony. You are tuned into So Hot right now on 2SER.
Yeah.
You have been listening to So Hot Right Now. My name is Nicole Beck, and as always, we bring you all things arts and culture from 11 a.m. till midday on your Saturday morning. And we had a totally full show today. We spoke about Blue Ridge Moon at Gallery Pom Pom, which is just on Abercrombie Street in Chippendale. The exhibition opens on Thursday. We spoke to artist Kylie Banyard all about her work. We also spoke about Extinction of the Learned Response, which is a crazy sci-fi realism work at Belvoir Street Theatre. So check that out, as well as A Hidden Pulse with Vivid Live and Talia Smith just there about Here Is Your Horizon, which is opening at Cement Fondue. Thank you so much for joining me on the show, and I hope that everyone has an absolutely fantastic Saturday. Shout out to my producer, and